Education for second. Anybody else has not received their homeworks back? Okay. I'm not going to go over anything about my homework. I'm going to go back to, well, first going to announce what I've sent you all an email about scheduling, and I've posted on the webpage about the scheduling of the review session. Unfortunately, as far as I can tell, the network outside this building is basically down at the moment. I had to, in order to find out the results of the poll this morning, I had to use my phone to go on the web because the network from the university was not working. So the emails to you won't have reached you yet, I think. Anyway, Tuesday at 3 o'clock in this room, so it was the clear winner. 3 or 3:30 both were okay, so I chose the earlier. It'll be at 3 here. For a couple of people, this is not good, and my apologies, they can email me, whatever, try to go over any questions with me outside of that review session. We will record the review session and immediately post it to the web right after. It'll be 2 hours of recording, but should work. Let's see, I think you have a homework to be returned. Yes, there's your homework. Okay, so we're talking about coalescence. There's a fair amount to cover, but I'm going to see what we can do. And once again, we're having a lighting problem. Well, maybe this will work, I don't know. I don't want to plunge you into darkness if I can help it.
Should we just open the window?
You can do that. I guess this somehow. You know what? Maybe there's a contrast adjustment on that projector, and if so, see, even this doesn't work, and we have to do as usual. We'll just go to. Yeah, you could maybe let a little. Well, you can also just twirl those plastic vertical things. Yeah. Something like that. Okay. Well, sorry about the lighting issue. Anyway, we're showing you coalescence, and where I was then headed was to say, well, that's for a population of constant size. You expect this coalescence, all these generalizations about the coalescence, the tree of genes forms at a given, let's say, a given site in the genome. Well, what happens if the populations change size? And there, actually, it's very easy. It is very much as if the box full of hyperactive bugs gets squeezed if you go back to a certain point in time, and then the population is smaller. In that generation, the bugs are squeezed into a smaller box and eat each other more rapidly. And essentially, at each time, the rate of coalescence is k times k minus 1 over 4 times the current population size. So the rates go up and down. So what you will have, if you look back in time, and this is now here at the right-hand end, and we have a population size. And by the way, departures from the Wright-Fisher model are taken into account by using something called the effective population size, which is an adjusted population size, adjusted for weirdnesses in the actual mating system. But the effective size, if you go back, if it were to go, say, go down and come to a low value and then rise a bit before that, this is going back earlier and earlier, what you will see is something like this. This is not a simulation, it's an artist's conception. You will see not too much coalescence up here. I mean, there will be because lineages coalesce rapidly at first, But as you go back in time, the population is getting smaller. Coalescence is occurring faster than before. And so you'll get a sort of wave of coalescence as you go back to this bottleneck. And then, if before that the population size was larger, you get, again, there would be some tendency not to coalesce for a while, but if it were to come back down again, then there would be more rapid coalescence. So you should see very crudely in the data waves of coalescence corresponding to very small, you know, bottlenecks in population size. However, it's very stochastic and noisy. If you go back far enough, everything has coalesced. Before that, there is no signal from coalescence at that locus. There's no information about population size. All we know is there's a single lineage, and it goes back forever. And it's really only when you have two or more lineages that you can say anything about what the population size was then. And if you try a lot of different loci in the genome, each one will show you a pattern like this. Each one will go back a certain distance, some of them further than others. So there'll be a little bit of information about distant population sizes, but it goes away. So there's a period in which you get information about population sizes out of the coalescent. But we don't observe the coalescent directly. We observe it only through the sequences at the tips. And that's a noisy inference as well, and we'll get to that. Okay, so population sizes have a rather direct effect on the coalescent. Migration and geographic structure also has an effect that you can think of fairly easily using what we know about the coalescent. So here, these two cylinders are different populations. Time is going vertically. We in the present take a sample of, say, five copies from this population and five copies from that population. Now, if you ask yourself, well, what would the genealogy of those be? It's very straightforward. In each population, there will be a coalescent. And it will depend on its population size. But suppose that there's a migration, a constant migration rate between these neighboring populations, so that you have, let's say, 1% every generation, 1% of the individuals are newly arrived from the other population. You have some number like that. Then each lineage, as you go back in time, has a 1% chance of being one that just arrived from the other. In other words, if you trace it back in time, it goes back over into the other. So here we have one of those migration events has caused this lineage to go over here. Now you get to here, these folks boiled down to three lineages at that point. This one joined them, becomes a fourth lineage, and then they coalesce. So as you go back from there, if you were like simulating a coalescent, a typical coalescent genealogy, it would show occasional movements like this. They join the other side. From that point on, there's one more lineage. They coalesce accordingly. Here's another one from this side, goes back over here. Here's one, this one. Everybody coalesces here. Now, if you get down to a point where there's one lineage in each population, there's no coalescing going on. There's nobody to coalesce with. But there is migration going on. So sooner or later, one of those will migrate over. Its ancestors will prove to be in the other population. Once they're there, there's a chance that they can coalesce, although there is a small chance that before they can coalesce, somebody else will go back over, and once again, the two lineages will get separated. They'll be going back and forth. So finally, they're in the population, and they happen to coalesce with each other, and then you just have a single lineage, which would go back in this population, although occasionally wandering over into the other one. But you can't see that. But below this point, the genetic differences among tips won't tell you anything. So that's it. That gives you a sort of intuitive feel, and you can make that. You can write expressions for the probability density of things, and I've done that a little in the text. But here we come to the real really interesting one, and that's recombination. Because recombination causes the coalescence at different parts of the genome to be a bit different. And there you have to, this is a very important point. We're used to the idea of using phylogenies and inferring them because somehow that seems to be important. And for phylogenies of, you know, species trees, it is important because whatever the species tree is, it affects all loci in the genome. It also affects the mitochondria as well. So if you can figure out what the phylogeny is for a set of species, that gives you very critical information about how to interpret differences not in any part of the genome, and of course in any characters that are controlled by any of those parts of the genome. When you have a coalescent, the situation is different. Because what we're going to imagine here is that in addition to the usual processes of there might be multiple populations, migration, changes of population size, all sorts of things, those events affect the whole genome. Recombination is local. And what it means is that you get a coalescent, and let's consider this, this is some chunk of genome and these little spikes are some kind of SNPs or something that were some places in the genome where something is being observed. And here are three of them, and they're undergoing a coalescence, except that at this point, in this generation, in this particular lineage, there is a recombination. And that means that this haplotype here, this particular instance, comes from a parent, but it does not, the whole thing does not come from the same genome, the same haploid genome in that parent. So if it was a little stretch of my genome and it went back to my, let's say, to my father, and there was a recombination between in the gametes that he produced, so that the particular gamete that I, you know, that came to make the zygote that made me, has a recombination. That means of the two haploid genomes that he's got for that little stretch, the first part of that stretch may have come from his maternal genome, and the second stretch might have come from his paternal genome. Now, going back before that, well, those are different haploid stretches. They go back to his two parents, and on back through the population. They basically will then be independent lineages going back. So here we are looking backwards in time. Here we get to where there's a recombination precisely at that point, and then we find that this first front section comes from over here. The back section comes from a different lineage. They both go back. There are now four relevant lineages, and they can coalesce with different lineages. They could coalesce with the same, or even with each other. And then what you get is that the light gray here is the coalescent tree for the first part of this haploid stretch. And the darker purple tree is the coalescent tree for the latter part. And so you see what happens there is, as you go along the genome, if you just start at this point, if you start at a single base, it'll have a coalescent. And you go to the next base in the sequence, and the next, and the next, and the next, and they will all have the same coalescent until you get to the point in the genome where somewhere in this tree there was a recombination. And then there's a change in the coalescent tree, which amounts to taking this branch, ripping it out, and having it coalesce with somebody else. So if I start with your genome, and I take, I take all of us, suppose we are again a sample, and I take, let's say, one haploid genome out of each of us, and I start marching along. If I start at one end of a chromosome, there is a coalescent. You may or may not be able to infer it, but there's a coalescent. And we keep marching down the chromosomes, and what we see, let me see if I, did I, no, I didn't, there's another figure that I didn't put in. As you march along, the coalescence stays the same and the same and the same and the same, until you come to a point where there's a recombination. And then you hear a ripping and a pasting noise, and the coalescent changes at least a little bit. A branch has moved in that coalescent. And then you march along further, rip, paste, and you march along further, rip, paste. And that keeps happening, and the coalescent is therefore changing. And the question really is to get a feel for how quickly the coalescents change along genomes in real cases. There, there is a generalization you can make, which is to say, the distance down the genome that it will take before you get a substantially different coalescent. Now, of course, you have to pin me down about what substantially means, is essentially, and I think this will be at least intuitively reasonable, the distance you'd have to go along the genome to have a, on average, one recombination between the tip and the root of the coalescent tree. And the root of the coalescent tree, you'll remember, is about 4N generations, or the really effective population size of 4N sub E generations back. And let me put it over here. I'll try to keep it away from the screen. So if you go 4N sub E generations back, and the recombination rate between the two points you're looking at, where you started and where you got to, where the coalescence is going to be substantially different, the number of generations in which there's a risk of recombination is 4NE on average, and the recombination rate between the two things you're looking at, the two points you're looking at, when that gets to be the place where that product is one, that's about when the coalescent tree has changed substantially. I can justify this more in more detail. I should point out also, there is a phenomenon of association between traits in populations. If you know a little population genetics, you may have heard about this mysterious thing called LD. It was invented, the phenomenon was known since 1916, I think it was. But the name was given to it by my thesis advisor, Richard Lewontin, in 1960. It's a terrible name. But linkage disequilibrium, which everyone calls LD, is a measure, is the name for measures of association between presences of alleles at different loci in a population. If the loci are segregating, if there is no association whatsoever, then knowing that an individual has a capital A allele at the A locus doesn't tell you anything about what it has at the B locus. The condition for linkage disequilibrium between two points in a population is exactly this. And that's for the simple reason that linkage disequilibrium and having similar coalescent trees are the same phenomenon. It's not just that they're magically connected, they're just different ways of describing the same thing. That when you're looking at regions that have the same or a similar coalescent, those are also regions of where linkage disequilibrium is present as a result of random genetic drift versus recombination. So that's about how far you have to go along the genome to get a different tree. And the question is, how far is this? If we take the number of recombinations In humans, we have about 33 per haploid genome, per say gamete, in per generation. And we have, of course, approximately, well, I think the current figure is now 2.9 times 10 to the 8 to the 9th bases in the genome. Many of you will say, oh no, it's 3.2. Apparently the number has dropped a little. Somebody can correct me if I'm wrong about that. Let's say that's nearly 3 times 10 to the 9. So that's roughly one recombination per 10 to the 8 bases. Every 100 million bases along the genome, if you look at an individual, you look at a gamete they produce, and ask, are there any recombinations in that gamete? It's about one every 10 to the 8. I think the latest, latest figures for humans may have raised that a little bit. But if we take that figure, then you could say, okay, what is, that will be the distance along the genome. Well, if the recombinations are evenly spread, randomly and evenly spread, which they aren't, but if they were, then we'd say, well, how far along the genome would we have to go? This can be turned into R equals 1 over 4n. If the effective population size in humans, well, in the past, back near out of Africa, it's thought to have been around 10,000, which is small. So, at what distance down the genome will the recombination rate be 1 in 40,000? Okay. Well, if you get 1 per 10 to the 8 bases, it's 10 to the 8th over 40,000. And let me see if I can do that. I always get it wrong. It's 100 million over 40,000, which is 10,000 over 4, or 2,500 bases. So what that says is the distance you have to go to get this modest amount of recombination, one part in 40,000, is about 2,500 kilobases, which isn't much. And in fact, you can say, well, maybe the effective size more recently has been bigger, so we could make it 100,000. If you do that, then it's even smaller. It's like 250 bases. So the point is that the tree is changing rather rapidly. And if you try to figure out like how many substantially different trees are there then for all the whole human genome, it is large. It's I can do it here, but it's something like 30,000 different trees. It's a large number. So there was a kind of study in the 1990s. It became common for people to take a part of the genome, take human sequences, get a sample of humans, make a tree, and then give a press conference. And they would get up there and they'd say, "I, the great so-and-so, have now inferred the genealogy of the human species." Applause, papers in the popular science press. So-and-so has the genealogy of the human species. But those were coalescents. So what they really should have said is get up on the podium and say, "I, the great so-and-so, have now inferred the genealogy of this tiny little itty-bitty bit of the human genome. And tomorrow morning, somebody else is going to get up and who studied a different locus is going to get up and say, I have got the genealogy of this other tiny little bit." And there's room for about 30,000 of those press conferences. So the stunning, The stunning relevance of any one coalescence is limited by the fact that it only applies to a small bit of the human genome. And in fact, a bit so small you can sort of say it's as if every gene has its own coalescent. That's not, you know, that's actually, there can be multiple coalescents even between two adjacent genes. Now, I've been making this calculation under the assumption that, that recombination is randomly spread out across the genome, and it's not. And we know there are hot spots and then cold regions in between where there's like 100-fold less recombination. So what really is happening is these distances are not quite relevant. What's relevant is if you're going through a cold region, probably the tree is the same. When you come to the next hot spot, that's like where you'll have a high amount of recombination, and the tree will change there. So really, it's like one tree per cold region of, in the hotspot structure of the human genome, there's one tree per cold region. That's basically what, you know, what the situation will be. And that, by looking at patterns of linkage disequilibrium, you can infer it's in the vicinity of tens of thousands of bases. Might be like 50,000 bases to the next tree. But that's not that much. And that still means that essentially every gene will have its own coalescent. So understanding this is really important because it gives you a feel for what any one coalescent applies to. It does not apply to the whole genome. It just applies to a tiny region of the genome, although it's correlated with what you'll find nearby. And therefore, inferring the coalescent and publishing it in a paper and saying, isn't this wonderful? Isn't it amazing that I got this coalescent? It has limited relevance. It will tell you what to expect in divergence in that little part of the genome. But it will tell you nothing much about what to expect a million bases further down the genome. That will be a totally different coalescent. Therefore, unlike a phylogeny, the emphasis with coalescence is not on inferring them and publishing them and putting a picture on your wall, because they don't apply to the whole genome. The emphasis is on knowing that there is one, and usually you can sort of infer it, but you don't have a lot of bases to estimate it. And so the technology turns out to be one where you're sort of averaging over the faint signal of the coalescent. You're averaging over what the coalescents there are likely to have been. And you can't apply that. You can't apply that to the exact genealogy of anywhere else in the genome. But what you can do is gain from coalescence information about parameters such as effective population size, migration rates, population size changes, growth rates, for example. Those can be inferred. They are parameters that apply to the whole genome, so you can infer them from multiple coalescents, and then they illuminate what coalescence you would expect in any given region. So that's the sort of general hand-wavy thing. Let me whisk through a few considerations, get to the multi-species angle, and then at least start in on the actual inference issues here. I'll just quickly say this. What you can show from the results that we've given, it will turn out that if you have a modest size sample, let's say 50 copies, and you take a small subset of them, like 10 copies, which I've done here, the coalescent tree you infer, if you were able to get the coalescent tree from that, you'll see, I'm flipping back and forth between them, that the deep branches are actually still there. A lot of the tip branches are not. So, it turns out that a lot of the information about things like effective population size is still there in a sample of 10 copies. There's a little bit more information in a sample of 50. the statistical power of making estimates of population parameters from coalescence plateaus rather rapidly. The first dozen or so copies are important. The next dozen, not so important. And very quickly, the signal becomes rather limited. You don't get that much out of taking very large samples. Let's see, I'm not going to go on that. What we like to do, one of the things we'd like to do is use all this coalescent information to make inferences about geographic differentiation and temporal changes. Here is a very abstract diagram of the out of Africa hypothesis. We would like to make from it estimates of when things happened and rates of migration and effective population sizes. I think I will not go on that further, but what I particularly want to do is talk about the relationship between coalescent trees and species trees. Now, there is a phrase, gene trees. You will hear it thrown around a lot. The unfortunate thing is I think it's a terrible phrase, and it's a terrible phrase because it means two different things. You can have gene trees, which are genealogical trees of individual copies of genes. That's what we've been talking about. Those are coalescent trees. But you can also have another kind of gene tree, and the phrase is used for that too. And that is the sequence of gene duplications that led to all of, say, my hemoglobin genes is a tree. And it's a tree of gene duplications of different loci. That too can be called a gene tree. Isn't the same beast at all. So I'm going to put quotes around gene trees and really say they're coalescent. Species trees are the phylogenies we know. Here is a species tree indicated as big wide strips here. Now you can say, well, suppose I take a population sample from each of those species. So I take three copies from the first species, three from the second, two and two from the next two. And I ask, what is their ancestry? And again, it's perfectly straightforward. Within each population, there will be a coalescent. So here are the coalescents going. In this case, the three have boiled down to one after a certain amount of time. Here, three have boiled down to one. These two have got down to here. They haven't yet coalesced. And now, we go back a little further, and if we could magically know the correct coalescent. When you get back to the point where the speciation occurred that separates these two species, that's here in this diagram, it's over here on that. As you go back further, those two will coalesce, these two will coalesce, these four will coalesce. Well, over here, there's just two lineages, they'll come together, they'll show a split. Now that split, which you can see at the molecular level when you look at numbers of differences between sequences, that is not, and if you can estimate that divergence time, it is not this divergence time, it's somewhat earlier. Okay. Over here, you have an even worse problem. These two sequences have got back to the speciation time. So of these, now they're just four species within a single species. That species may have one population or it may have geographic structure. We haven't really said. But suppose it were one population, then those four will coalesce and they'll just coalesce in any old order. And if they do that, then you're quite likely to get a tree of gene copies, a coalescent tree, that is inconsistent with where you sampled those copies from in the two species. So this lineage, which comes from the left species, coalesces with that one that comes from the right. Then that ancestor coalesces with the other one from the left, and then they finally coalesce with the other one from the right. So there start to be inconsistencies between coalescent trees and species trees, between quotes, gene trees and species trees. And that continues on back. Now, whether or not there are those depends upon how rapidly things coalesce in the time it takes to get back to the split. So it depends on how long ago it is to the split. And it also depends upon the effect of population sizes in those populations. Even thinking of them as single populations, there's also the issue of if they have geographic structures, a very, very important issue. You'll remember that the time back to when all copies coalesce, if there's a moderate to large number of copies, is approximately 4NE generations. So the question is T bigger than 4NE generations? This is time back to speciation of the two species you're looking at. Whether or not you'll get discrepancies between gene trees and species trees, between coalescent trees and species trees, depends on whether the divergence times are bigger or small, a lot bigger than 4NE or a lot smaller than 4NE. And in between, there will be a region where you sometimes get discrepancies and sometimes not. In the human, for example, in trees of different loci in the human genome, when we look at human, chimp, and gorilla, we find that 70% of loci, and that's where we just take one copy from each. So we're saying, here we'll draw the tree is human, chimp, gorilla. If you take a single copy from each, what'll happen is it'll go back, and when you get down to here, those two may or may not coalesce by the time they get back to the common ancestor of human, chimp, gorilla. It depends upon the effective population size and the extent of time in this region of the tree when you've only got one lineage from each. What you find when you do that, you take one lineage from each in human, chimp, and gorilla, is that about 70% of loci do coalesce in this interval and show you, therefore, the human and chimp as closest relatives. 30% do not. Half of them show human with gorilla, half of them show chimp with gorilla, which is exactly what you'd expect from a simple coalescent model of things. But it gives you a feeling of how that divergence time, how the time of the common ancestor of human and chimp after it split with gorilla, how long that is relative to its effective population size. You can make an estimate of the ratio of T to 4NE during that period from that. Okay. Here is another tree with bigger populations, and I'm just again drawing what it would look like, and you're seeing that although over here everybody coalesces, here these don't. You can think of there being different effective population sizes in each of those lineages, although of course that's an oversimplification. There could be a complicated history of rises and falls in population size within each of those lineages. There's no law that says the population size stays constant after the split from between, say, human and chimps. So discrepancies between coalescent trees and species trees are very common, particularly for recent divergences, or even for divergences some time ago, but where the lineages you're looking at successively split rather rapidly. So you expect discrepancies between coalescent trees and species trees. You might look at that and say, well, then it's hopeless. We can't ever estimate the phylogeny, because any gene we look at, its genealogy won't exactly be that of the species. But each region, there's lots of these coalescent trees in the genome, and each region of the genome will sample this separately. And so by combining data from a lot of loci, you can make an inference of the phylogeny, even though each individual locus might be a little bit discrepant with it. Now, there's a whole literature out there about things like concatenating loci, about things like not concatenating loci. Everybody fights about it. They're busy fighting about it right now. For those of you who came to this course hoping I would spend 2 or 3 weeks on this topic, I'm sorry, it's more like 10 minutes. That's true of a lot of things. Okay, so there is this complication and the very real need for you to separate in your minds the coalescent trees and the species trees. Species trees apply to the whole species, the coalescent trees to small pieces of the genome. Fortunately, there are a whole bunch of them. So you get to put that information together. You can think of that. Okay. Now, this is an entire lecture to be done in the next 8 minutes. Because we're running out of course. There's a very interesting question of what machinery you can use to do things like make a likelihood for a sample of genomes from a population. So what we have here, the big ellipse is a population. There's some region of the genome we're sequencing. We have a bunch of possible sequences we could have collected from different individuals. The blue ones here are the ones we actually did collect. Now we're back to one species at the moment. In this case, one population. And we might say, okay, I want to compute a likelihood for that collection. What can we do? Well, you can say, well, the likelihood would be the probability of all those sequences. How does one think about that? One thinks that if this is a small enough region of the genome that we can ignore recombination, that's a big if, there is then a coalescent tree. If recombination occurred within this region, there is kind of a thing called an ancestral recombination graph, which is trees pasted together. I don't want to go there at the moment. If we knew the genealogy, if somebody came along and told us what this genealogy was, then we could say, oh, okay, we can compute the probability of evolving these sequences. We would do so, by the way, under a neutral mutation model, because once you put selection in, things get very messy and ugly. And we can say, okay, it's just the same problem we had with phylogenies. For each possible tree, there is a probability of the data given that tree. The catch is we don't know the tree. And the math, I'll just give you a quick panel on the math, is that if I have a population, I have some data, which is some sequences at a particular locus that I've sampled, and there are the unknown values, the effective population size, and the neutral mutation rate per site. The way you have to think about computing the likelihood is to compute the probability of your data set given these parameters. Now remember, the parameters aren't the tree in this case, they're these things. And what we have to do is sum up over all possible trees that could connect those sequences, and not just over all tree topologies, but all divergence times, all branch lengths as well. And for each of those trees, G prime here, we have a product of two terms. And it turns out to be the probability of that tree given the effective population size, and then a term that's the probability of the data given that tree, which is what we were talking about a moment ago when we thought we knew the tree. We don't know the tree. We have to average over trees, weighting each by its probability under Kingman's formulas. And that sounds difficult. It's not too bad. For any one tree, we already know this part because it's just the ordinary likelihood of random changes of nucleotides on that tree. It's the likelihood we've been talking about, and we have algorithms for computing it. Kingman's prior is also not particularly difficult. It's a pretty simple, once you know the tree, it's a pretty simple expression. once the tree, once you know the coalescent tree and a population whose effective population size is known. So you might think, okay, we know how to compute the two parts, that's great. The killer is this sum. We have to do it for every possible coalescent, and there are an awful lot of coalescents. A small footnote, you can rescale the tree so its branches are not in generations, but in mutational units, in a mutational time. So one unit is the time when a base, on average, gets a mutation. When you do that, what you find out is you get the same expression, except now the parameters, which were separate, there was an N and a mu, have moved together. You get a compound parameter, 4N times the mutation rate, and the whole thing becomes an expression involving that. What that means is you cannot separately estimate the effective population size and the mutation rate, because all you're looking at is the sort of differences between a bunch of sequences. And if I say to you, well, here's a scenario with a tree of a certain depth and a mutation rate, if somebody comes along and says, no, let's try a tree that is twice as deep, but let's drop the mutation rate by half, well, you can kind of see that the mutations are occurring along the coalescent tree. So if the coalescent tree is the same shape, but gets twice as deep, but at the same time the mutation rates are only going half as fast, then the result is expected on average to be the same. So the probability of any pattern of DNA sequences depends upon this product, 4N mu, and not separately on N and mu. So that's a useful fact. We're down to one parameter in a simple single population case. And I guess the a thing to emphasize here is that when we're averaging over all possible trees, we're averaging over all the different coalescents that could arise. And that is one of the big sources of uncertainty, of noise in the data. Okay. The other source of noise is that for each of these trees, there is the random issue of when and where the mutations will occur on that tree. So there's two sources of noise. One of them is random mutation, but the other is random coalescence that created the genealogy that exists there, whether or not you can see it exactly. So that's important to keep in mind. You can reduce the noise in mutation by looking at longer sequences. You can reduce the noise about the noise coming from the coalescence mostly by looking at more loci. More parts of the genome. Okay. Finally, I'll end up saying here is, and there is more on this in the chapter. This will be chapter 20. Let's see, which is it? 25, 26. I believe it's chapter 27 and 28. In the anyway, it's in those. It's in there. If you have, I'll give you a little on this next time, and then we have to go on to consensus trees, but if we have two copies, the smallest possible case, the whole tree boils down to the waiting time, the time until the divergence of those two copies. When you consider different possible times, you're then considering different trees. That's the only kind of variation you have in the tree. And what I'll show you next time is that the likelihood for this pair of sequences is the average over all of these possible times, weighted by their probabilities depending upon this compound parameter, 4NU, and the product of the Kingman part and the likelihood part is an integral of the product of this thing times the product of that thing, and it gives you a number where the likelihood is a function of this theta, and there's going to be a curve of those. I think next time I will just show you that and then tell you there is a whole lecture on using Markov chain Monte Carlo methods to infer these things. And it will take place in the second quarter of this course, which unfortunately does not exist. So we will stop there, and the last lecture will be next.